Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
I'm delighted now to be joined by the celebrated American author Curtis Sittenfeld. Welcome, Curtis.
Thank you.
And Curtis, people will know you as the writer of novels like American Wife, Rodham, Romantic Comedy, and I very much enjoyed your new collection of short stories. It's your second and it's called Show, Don't Tell. You kind of straddle very well that line between critical acclaim and popularity. I presume popularity in readers is the main goal. Is the critical acclaim nice too? Do you read all the reviews?
So it's funny. I wish that I could say no, and the answer is yes. But sometimes there's a bad review and it's behind a paywall. And I always think that's really funny because then I can't access it, which is a relief.
Yeah. OK. And like, you're not going to pay to read a bad review of yourself, are you?
Oh, God, no. I only read bad reviews for free.
So you say the new book is an ode to middle age. And so FYI, I'm middle aged too. OK.
Congratulations.
So you're 49 now. How have you found your 40s? Start with the positives, maybe.
So I think that I have like incredibly rich, deep friendships, and I talk really openly with my friends about sort of like our crazy life experiences, you know, the craziness of like the things that happen to your body as you get older, the things that happen to your parents as you get older, that happen, you know, to your family. So I feel really connected to my close friends. I would say that's probably the most positive part.
And the negatives? We have time. We have all the time in the world.
I mean, I think that thing is real where you can feel sort of pulled perhaps between aging parents and children. I think that most marriages that have lasted for like 15 or 20 years, I think some are like magnificent and never better. I don't think that's true for most of them. Like, I think there can be like dips in that area. There are very real challenges, like health challenges start to crop up for people. So do you think I'm missing anything?
No, I think that's a fairly good roundup of the situation. I want to come back to marriage because there's a lot of marriages and long-term relationships in the stories and I'm interested in your take on it. Before we get to that, it's interesting that you say about the friendships and the openness of how you communicate with your friends now and everything. Do we become less neurotic as well as we get older, maybe?
I would say no, but I would say maybe we become more accepting of our own neuroses and other people's neuroses. And I do feel like I can have the capacity to bond very quickly with other people, even if it's like a bunch of women talking about perimenopause or menopause, and we've never met each other before. Or like we have a couple friends in common or something. You can get down to it very quickly. So I think that these sort of challenging experiences or even like humiliations can be a point of bonding and connection. And I think also, as you get older, you kind of know that everyone's life is messy and you don't have to conceal your own messiness as much.
Absolutely, yeah. Wouldn't you love to be young and think it's all so simple? But it is good to get older and realize, look, it's all complicated and everyone's complicated. You see, yeah. They talk about a midlife crisis, but listening to us talking here now, it's kind of less a crisis really than a liberation, is it?
I think so. But also, like, why choose? It can be both.
Yeah. I know how men tend to handle the crisis/liberation. How do women tend to handle it?
I mean, I actually think that that transcends gender. I think it seems like a lot of people I know either have stopped drinking, like they didn't necessarily come to a crisis, but they stopped drinking, or are drinking more than ever.
Yes, I think you're right. You wrote this letter to the readers of the book and you say in it that you're alarmed and fascinated by how reflexively our culture disparages aging, especially for women. So are you already feeling that sense, like this is quite depressing, that at 49 you're starting to be viewed as over the hill in some way?
Well, if I'm not mistaken, I think women in their 20s get Botox now. I don't know. Like, it just feels like there's so much pressure and conformity. I mean, there always has been pressure and conformity around appearance, but the intersection of appearance, aging, cosmetic surgery, and the internet is intense. Aging naturally is considered notable. Not dyeing your hair, not doing any sort of interventions of any sort is considered a little bit unusual, I think. Do you think so?
I think it's almost something that people admire these days. They go, well, look at her. Isn't she brave? She's letting it happen.
Whenever you're told that you're brave, the subtext is like, I wouldn't do that, but best of luck to you.
Yeah, you're brave. I'm right behind you, not doing it. It's funny. The whole tweakments and Botox and everything came in here very quickly. We regarded it probably, I don't know, I'd say even 5 years ago as quite an American thing or something kind of unusual. And now, certainly, I think a lot of the middle-aged women I know now, even for work reasons and everything, basically feel that in ways they have no choice but to kind of try and disguise aging.
Yeah, I think that I should not be judgmental. I have a lot of compassion. And
listen, to be clear, as a man, I'm not judging any woman's choices. Let's be clear there. Yeah.
we don't do that in 2025, except for the people who do it really aggressively. The rest of us don't do that. But like, just what is considered normal or middle of the road in terms of appearance can shift very rapidly. And I mean, it's also really striking to me, just in conversation, how much intelligent, successful women who are my age, which again is, 49, 50, might essentially use the words old and bad interchangeably. So like, does this make me look old? I did that and then I felt so old. And it's kind of like, well, there are disadvantages to being old, but there are advantages too.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of lust in the stories as well. And it kind of made me realize middle-aged lust doesn't really get a fair crack of the whip either, does it? Do you think passion and lust change for better or worse in midlife?
Well, first of all, I have to say thank you. Like, I don't even know if you intend that as a compliment, but saying there's a lot of lust in the stories, I'm like, oh, that's very high praise. The funny thing
there is desire, I think, possibly, as well as lust, maybe.
Yeah. I mean, I would say that actually, maybe the thing that I think is interesting is that I don't think desire and lust change that much over time. Like, I think that people can still, when they're 50 or 60, can feel the way they felt when they were 15 or 20. And like, that's the surprising part.
Mm-hmm. Do you not think desire and lust can be a lot more interesting, actually, as you get on?
Oh, yeah. For the same reason that like, friendship can be more interesting. I mean, just you're like a more complex person who's had more interesting life experiences, and also ideally you sort of have more perspective and are more kind of grounded. I mean, not always, but maybe.
Yeah, like, look, let's face it, the crooked piece of timber is a lot more interesting than the 2x4, isn't it?
I've never heard that, but yes.
It's mine. You can have it. You can take it, Curtis, okay? Listen, going back to marriage, look, I don't want to sound defensive here. I found some of the stories very funny about marriage, but a little bit down on it, in that I suppose some of the women in the stories, they're either in unhappy marriages or they're misunderstood by their husbands or they're divorced. Is that a lot of what you're seeing around you?
I mean, I'm sorry to say, I think the short answer is yes. Like, anecdotally, I know a lot of women in heterosexual marriages that are, about 20 or 25 years in duration, and the women are not particularly satisfied.
And when you say satisfied, I think you mean it broadly. Are the women kind of bored with the men? Do the men get boring? Is that what happens? Or do they stop seeing the women as well?
It's a good question. It's obviously incredibly hard to talk in such generalizations. And I certainly know.
Yeah, but you know what? It's okay to blame the men, okay? We have a rule around here. You can say what you want about men, okay? So we're on safe ground.
I mean, I would say I personally have sometimes thought that many heterosexual marriages could be improved 75% if the man gave the woman a heartfelt compliment every other day and nothing else changed.
Okay, I like it. Have you got anything else? Anything else for the men listening? There's one that could change everything, yeah.
Well, I do think, you know, the division of labor can be a huge thing where things shifted very rapidly from like our parents' generation to our generation, where I think maybe Gen X men feel a little caught in the middle where sometimes they're like, I do so much more than my father. And the response might be, well, your father did almost nothing. Yeah. Should you be
congratulated? I'm doing 100% more than my boomer father did.
Yeah. It's like, well, is that something to get excited about? I don't know.
Yeah, okay. In the story, The Patron Saints of Middle Age, there's this devastating line, right? I'll quote it for people. Once at a 10-person dinner party, it occurred to me that if we were attending as strangers rather than as spouses, we'd likely find each other to be the 8th or 9th most interesting person at the table. And it was funny because I think we don't even allow ourselves to think those things generally. And then it got me thinking, do we all lie to ourselves about things like that to keep the marriages on track? Is that what's going on?
Well, okay, obviously marriages come in very different shapes and sizes. You know, I think that sometimes lying to yourself can probably be likelier to result in the outcome you want. Like seeing things too clearly is not always, I don't know, it doesn't always make you happier or improve your life situation.
Yeah. But then, and again, there's probably a cultural difference between what I see and you see in terms of this. In the midlife you describe in the stories, I think people often get a second chance at life or happiness or fulfillment. Is that more an accepted part of the story of life in America now, that people do get a second act and a second crack off things and that's okay?
Oh, that's really interesting. Like, I mean, I guess, are you asking, are people less judgmental about divorce?
Is it just more an accepted part of life now that it's second time around is often when it works out for people? Because we're still probably not quite there culturally here, I think.
Oh, that's interesting. I mean, if any person gets divorced, it's sort of seen as a bit sad, but it's not seen as scandalous.
So listen, tell me a bit about your own background. So I was reading that you come from a Catholic Jewish household, I think. That's a heady mix, isn't it?
There's a lot of guilt.
Yeah, I was wondering, are you Catholic guilty or Jewish guilty?
A little of both.
Yeah, okay. I think the key part is which one was the mother, because presumably she's the one who really laid it on you.
So my mother is Catholic and my father was Jewish. So I was christened and I had a first communion, and I don't consider myself to be a religion now. Like, I don't practice any religion. I would say I think I feel more culturally Jewish than Catholic.
Did your mother still manage to do a number on you?
No, my mother is actually, and she went to Catholic school her whole life. But as a side note, as a family, we loved Dairy Girls and were, you know, fascinated by it. But she liked seeing the students with the nuns as teachers, and because she had that herself many years ago. But my mother is not a guilt-inducing mother. She's like a pretty... I had a father who passed away in 2021 who had a very strong personality. And my mother is more laid back, actually.
Okay. I saw you say somewhere that in your youth, you should have spent more time cutting class and drinking beer. Were you a very serious, responsible young woman?
So I would say yes, although I was probably a less good student than that might imply. I mean, I spent a lot of time writing from a very young age, from the age of like 6 or 7, a lot of time writing, a lot of time reading. I wasn't breaking rules, I guess. I wasn't necessarily studying either.
Okay. What kind of earnest and kind of introvert?
Yeah, I think so.
And then have you got more extrovert as you've got older?
Yeah, I think so. And especially, you know, it's like my first novel came out 20 years ago. And so I've also become accustomed to kind of, you know, doing events in public And like, I think I am an introverted person still and spend a ton of time by myself, but I'm not very socially nervous at this point. And certainly as a teenager, I was often very socially nervous.
Okay. Privilege is one of the themes in your writing. So I feel okay to kind of ask you this, that you did have quite a privileged education yourself, a good school, then Vassar and Stanford for college. How does that kind of education shape you?
Oh my goodness, in a lot of ways. I mean, so, and it's definitely true. Like, I was very lucky to get like a great education that my parents paid for that I did not pay for. I mean, I paid for it when I went to graduate school, but that was the least expensive part. But it definitely perpetuates, like, going to sort of fancy schools introduces you to other people who go to fancy schools and, you know, maybe work in similar industries, or you can, you know, maybe you remind someone of, like, there's an editor and the editor reminds you of herself at a younger age or something. Or like my first novel was set at boarding school, which has this cachet for people who did go there. It has cachet for people who didn't go there. In sort of concrete and abstract ways, I have definitely benefited from people I met and the prestige attached to some of the schools I attended. You know, I feel like it's important for me to acknowledge that.
It's interesting what you say about that. You meet an editor and they remind you of someone you know, that kind of tribal thing almost. There's a... You know that guy who wrote, remember he wrote that book, Bobos in Paradise, about the bourgeois bohemians? But he wrote again recently about, he was writing about the new kind of class system. But what he said that your kind of education gives people is ease, E-A-S-E, and that is the difference between people who had that education and people who didn't, that you have ease in certain circles.
I think that's accurate. That's very accurate. Like you feel a little bit like the good parts of the world were meant for you. Like you were meant to enjoy a nice restaurant. Like you were meant to be in, you know, a lovely park. Like you can pop into a fancy hotel and
you're not apologizing for yourself in the lobby.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. You.
And then I was surprised that you live in Minneapolis, which is in the Midwest of America. I think I slightly expected you to live in New York and have a glamorous writer's life at cocktail parties, being waspish with other writers. But anything I've read, you seem a bit more like a regular Midwestern kind of working mom, are you?
Yeah, I would say that's much more accurate. I'm glad. I want you to think that I'm like going to glamorous parties. And I mean, it's like, again, Minneapolis is exceptionally cold. It's, you know, one of the very coldest places that you could live in the United States. So it's like I spend a lot of time walking around in snow by myself. And then I spend a lot of time, you know, like going to the grocery store. I mean, I work and I write and I have wonderful friend. Like Minneapolis is a big city with a lot of writers, but it's not New York.
Okay. But there is kind of there's an arty kind of scene there and there are people like you there.
Oh, absolutely. It's where, so Prince is from Minneapolis and chose to stay here all along. And, you know, Louise Erdrich lives in Minneapolis. Like I lived in St. Louis, Missouri, which I had, it was a really positive experience. I lived there for 11 years, but sometimes people would say to me, so why do you live in St. Louis? And then living in Minneapolis, it would be much more unlikely that someone would say, why do you live in Minneapolis? It would be understood.
Okay, gotcha. Listen, so you're a Democrat. You campaign for Kamala Harris. How does America feel to you right now?
Oh, my God. I mean, it feels very fractured and it feels like a very surreal moment.
And often you speak to people from America and they say, look, no, that's what you're seeing in the media and that's what you're seeing online from over there. But in day-to-day life, people are actually not that fractured and not that polarized.
It's hard to say because it kind of depends on the moment. You know, like most people I know voted the way I did.
Okay. Yeah.
But if I drove for 20 minutes in a few different directions, I could encounter a lot of people who did not vote the way I did. And there's different people, you know, there's sort of white women with college degrees overwhelmingly vote Democratic. But I think there's maybe more educated men who vote basically on like how they think the stock market will do or something. Yeah.
So the women are voting kind of socially and ideologically and stuff like that, whereas the men are voting with some kind of basic economic kind of thing. Yeah. You've written two acclaimed political novels. So American Wife was based on the life of Laura Bush, wife of George W. And then Rodham, which was hugely successful, is an imagining of Hillary Clinton's life if she didn't stay with Bill. Are you fascinated by political women?
I mean, I do think I'm kind of fascinated by politics. Also, in Show Don't Tell, obviously, the sort of celebrity and fame is kind of a recurring theme, because I think that there are these personalities that we get exposed to when someone is super famous. And it's really hard to assess how much we're seeing their quote unquote real self and how much it's a more performative self. And I think that not knowing is very intriguing. And like it can seem, or even like a celebrity posting on social media, and if it's like riddled with typos, you think, well, I think the celebrity must have really done that, because it would have been cleaner if they're publicist. And so I think there's some of that with the politicians or political spouses, where you kind of feel like they're very constrained by what they can say, but that doesn't mean that they're always being insincere, but then probably sometimes they're insincere. So it's like, what am I really getting? What is behind the curtain? Like, those questions are intriguing to me.
Yeah. So then that begs the question, will there be a Melania Trump book?
There will not be.
No?
No, there will not be.
You don't think there's enough there for you, no?
I mean, so I think that that's not how I want to kind of direct my energy and my attention.
I hear you. I hear you, Curtis. I hear you. In a way, I think people have had a strange feeling in a way recently again. Does Trump's election make you almost nostalgic for the likes of George W. Bush? Like, you wrote about him with some humanity in American Wife, and I think you got some flack for it at the time. But would you take him now as a president?
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. Absolutely.
Yeah. It's amazing how much the calculus has changed, isn't it?
As to what a terrible
Republican is like. Yeah. You also got flack for the sex scenes in Rodham between Bill Clinton and Hillary. And I think you felt people misunderstood them and their purpose. What did we misunderstand?
Well, I mean, I think that I can understand how a person, you know, so Rodham is an alternate history if Hillary had not married Bill. But she does, in Rodham, they meet in law school, they fall in love, they consider getting married. In real life, he proposed twice and she said no, and then he proposed a third time and she says yes. And in the book, she says no the third time too. So it's like, I definitely think a part of their connection was being attracted to each other. And it's like, it's so thrilling to kind of like be attracted to someone and respect them intellectually. And I think that, I mean, again, what do I know? I've never met either of them, but I think that that's probably part of their connection. So if, I felt like, of course, or like, if you're writing fiction, it's almost like, especially if you're writing, you know, that it is imaginative, it is not factual, but if you're writing fiction about public figures, of course you go in the bedroom. Of course you go in the bathroom. Like, you go the places that nonfiction doesn't really take you. Otherwise, why bother, right? Like fiction can be so intimate, and that's like one of its strengths. And also, like, you know, people can have sort of different sides to themselves sexually than they have in a more public way. And so again, like, how could any fiction writer resist including that? And why would any writer or any reader want them to?
Yeah. Were you ever in a room with Bill Clinton?
I have heard both of them speak. So, like, I have been in a room with thousands of other people and the Clintons.
Yeah, I presume, though, you've heard from people who have been in a room. It's just when you said there about, of course, there was going to be sexual frisson between them, that, you know, people do talk about being in a room with Bill Clinton, that he is absolutely just magnetic.
I have heard that many times, yes, that even including people who, like, think they don't like him or plan to disapprove of him and then just almost, like, meet him and melt into a puddle.
Listen, though, it is a fine line, right? I mean, the story in the new book, which is essentially, no, you're going to say, no, it's not. But I mean, I'll be delicate how I say this. One could imagine that it could be roughly about someone like Amazon owner Jeff Bezos and his first wife in their early years. Are you not nervous fictionalizing someone who's so close to him?
I mean, I'm not completely not nervous, but I don't think that as a writer, I don't think I act in bad faith, which of course, you know, I would think that, and that is a subjective assessment, but I don't think I ever try to humiliate a public figure. And in fact, I think the opposite inevitably happens, where, like, we can sometimes treat public figures as if they're one-dimensional and they exist only when we are observing them. And so it's almost like to show a public figure in fiction, like brushing their teeth, it's almost like inherently personalizing or humanizing, because it's like this reminder, like, their lives are really different from the lives of, like, regular people in most ways, but not in all ways. And, like, they do have emotions and they do have vulnerabilities. Yeah. And so I don't think I'm ever
just,
trying
to be clear, by the way, I wasn't questioning the ethics of it. I was more questioning, were you not afraid that he'd come after you with a load of expensive lawyers or anything?
It's probably not worth the time and effort of someone to do. And if someone did that, if someone is so high profile did that, it would really attract a lot of attention to my fiction. Not like I'm saying I hope that will happen, but I'm saying, you know, like, if ever I've accidentally blurted out some remark that was a little overly honest in an interview, I have the impulse to then almost, like, post on social media and say, like, this is what I really meant. And anyone who works in publicity would say, just treat it like it never happened. Like, you will only make it bigger. So yeah. I would think if somebody objected to my fictional portrayal, I mean, it's a story collection. Like, just let it disappear. Like,
yeah. So you were involved in an intriguing experiment recently with the New York Times, where you basically went up against ChatGPT to write a Curtis Sittenfeld story. Will you tell me about that?
So I agreed to this experiment where I was given a prompt and ChatGPT was given a prompt, which was write a short story that includes these elements. And I think that ChatGPT was write in the style of Curtis Sittenfeld. And then the New York Times ran both stories without saying who wrote which one, and readers were supposed to guess.
Yeah, it was pretty obvious, I would have thought. How did you think ChatGPT did on writing Curtis Sittenfeld? How offended or concerned were you by it?
So, I found it a tiny bit funny, because in terms of the language, it did not remind me of the way that I use language. But some of the details, like, I think it was like a middle-aged Midwestern woman. I think that maybe she was like an editor or wrote for a magazine. And, like, there were two possible stories that the editor, the New York Times editor, kind of extracted from ChatGPT. And one of them had several characters, had names of people, like even like my family members, which was a little unsettling or something. So I wasn't like, oh, this has no relationship to my writing, but sentence by sentence or like emotion by emotion, it did not remind me of my own writing.
Yeah, of course, as you were talking, I just realized something. It was trained on your books, presumably, as well, was it?
Well, yes, it was, without my permission or consent or compensation. But it was also trained on, you know, millions of other books.
So the thing about the other story was that if you didn't know, what worried me was I wasn't sure that I would have known it was not written by a human being. But then, you know, I read yours first and I knew there was a human being there. Then I knew the other one wasn't. But if I had read the other one first, I don't think I would have thought it was you, but I might have thought it was written by a human being. But then when I read it after yours, I thought, no, there's no human being involved here. There's no humanity involved. Do you know what I'm saying?
I think, yeah, I agree actually with everything you're saying. But again, if you think about it, it's using language based on having ingested lots of written documents and then sort of reconstituting them. So it is using patterns that humans have created, patterns of language. So I think maybe what you're saying is correct, but shouldn't be surprising. But
so it's doing an impersonation of a human being, but it actually doesn't know what it's talking about. And you can, as a human being, you can kind of see that.
But I will say I cannot always recognize AI imagery, which my kids can. So they'll see something and they'll be like, oh, that's AI. And then when they say it, I'm kind of like, oh, I think you're right. But I did not know it. So yeah. Like, I think doing this whole exercise, the AI experiment, I was not like, oh, this is so reassuring. Like, and also I think it took ChatGPT 17 seconds to write its story.
And it took you 49 years, essentially.
Oh my God, I know, yeah, exactly. Depending on how you calculate, it took me either like 3 weeks or 49 years or some combination.
Okay, are you worried then as a writer?
I mean, I'm not worried. Like, I could sort of mock the results now, but I think that it will potentially improve very rapidly.
Yeah, that's the thing. Okay, finally, one of the stories in the new book concerns the Mike Pence rule. So first, for people who aren't familiar with it, what is the Mike Pence rule?
So the Mike Pence rule, which is also known as the Billy Graham rule, after like an evangelical figure here, and it's the belief that a man and a woman should never be alone together socially or professionally because, you know, they might accidentally have sex.
Yes, and we're laughing about it now. But on the other hand, the story does kind of suggest that accidents can happen when men dine alone with women who are their wives, doesn't it?
Well, I mean, this is the thing, that I don't want to create straw men in my fiction. Like, I don't want to humiliate anybody, and I don't want to weigh the scales very heavily. Like, I don't want to be like, I want to write characters who are nuanced and complicated and contradictory the way that real people are. So you know, mm-hmm. a person can be very smart about some things in their life and very foolish about other things, or, you know, very morally scrupulous in some areas and not morally scrupulous in yes. other areas. And so thinking that the Mike Pence rule is, you know, sexist, heteronormative, offensive, doesn't necessarily keep you from having an affair. Like, all those things can coexist.
Yes. Do you have male friends you join alone with?
I do.
Yeah.
There was a Washington Post article that came out when Mike Pence was vice president that kind of drew attention to his practice of this rule. And I and, you know, liberal progressive people like me felt like this is preposterous. Yeah. And then I thought to myself, but do I actually spend much time one-on-one? Or like, if I, you know, like, as you said, I don't live in New York. And if there was like some, you know, married man on my street and I said, would you like to get lunch? I think that he would probably think like, what's going on? So, but when I thought about it, the exception to the rule is I would think nothing of having, like spending time one-on-one with another writer. Like, I feel like there's lots of,
yeah, because we all know that writers never misbehave.
I know. That's exactly the reason why.
Curtis, it's been an absolute pleasure. And Show, Don't Tell is out now and it's terrific. And it's published by Doubleday. Curtis Sittenfeld, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. This was so fun.